It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 1 million people in the U.S. have died of COVID-19 as of last week. A Wisconsin philosopher who studies trauma tells us why it can be hard to make sense of the scale of loss caused by the pandemic. First, job openings in the U.S. continue to be at record levels, and the number of workers quitting their jobs is, too. The labor market shift has been called the Great Resignation. According to a recent report from the research firm Gartner, it may be a permanent change in many fields instead of a temporary one. Our next guest recently took a closer look at that research and spent some time thinking about what the forever resignation could mean for employers and workers. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have you quit a job during the pandemic to find something new, to retire maybe earlier than you planned? Did you stay within a field or did you reevaluate the whole thing and go into something different? Employers, are you still seeing lots of turnover? How would you feel if things stayed this way and didn't go back to normal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. Aki, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us some more about this report predicting higher workplace turnover, maybe for the long run here?
Sure. So I think, you know, every employer in America right now is staring at very, very high attrition rates. And they're all wondering, when is this going to end? And I think most of them are expecting it to end at some point. You know, it's just around the corner. Everything's going to go back to the pre-pandemic normal very soon. But this new report from the research firm Gartner predicts that we're never going to go back to that pre-pandemic normal. They estimate that voluntary turnover is going to be 20% higher than it was before the pandemic. And that's a big shift. You know, in a large company with, let's say, 25,000 employees, that means an additional 1,000 people would be quitting every year compared to what the quitting rate was before the pandemic.
Now, this may look different from industry to industry. A lot of your recent piece on this, Aki, looks at white collar jobs in particular. What are some of the things that have been happening in that sector that's making them think, yeah, maybe this keeps going?
The number one thing is the increase in remote work. And nobody thinks that we're going back to the kind of in-person, in-office work that we had before the pandemic. That's the one thing that we're always going to keep. And as a result, that means, you know, we're going to see some changes in the way that the job market actually functions. Remote work is important for attrition for two reasons. One is that in a remote environment, workers feel less attached to their jobs because they feel less attached to their colleagues. That was traditionally something that kept them from resigning, even if the job wasn't good for them or the pay wasn't great. The second factor with remote work is that you just have so many more options than before because you're no longer limited to your local job market. And that means that with more options, workers are more likely to quit to go to a different employer. And that once again elevates the attrition rate too.
Right. Did I see you quoted somebody who's working in Baltimore, not seeing jobs they'd want to switch to in their neighborhood, but they could remote work for a company they liked in London?
Yeah, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, and that is part of what's driving people to seek jobs. I can search the job market and I don't have to go to them if I don't want to.
And this is a really important point here is that it permanently gives more power to workers. You know, the more options you have, the more bargaining power you have, you know, the more likely you'll be able to find a job that's good for you. So this is all around great news for workers.
Now, obviously, this isn't remote work isn't an option in all lines of work. A lot of service type jobs and manufacturing, things like that, you got to go there. Are there thoughts in the industry, though, that at least some of this resignation trend will continue even in work in person places?
It's very possible. I mean, some of the highest quitting rates that we're seeing across the country are in leisure and hospitality jobs, the majority of which are in-person jobs. So that we could keep seeing that for a long time as well. But it wouldn't be related to this increase in remote work that we're seeing in white collar professional jobs.
We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy and the labor market. we're looking at this big trend. We've talked about it on the show before. A lot more people than usual quitting their jobs, often to take on a new job or start a new career or maybe retire early. Want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Have you quit a job, changed a job, worked remotely for a new employer lately, or do you like where you are and you're sticking with it? Love to hear from people from a variety of types of jobs, whether you have left a service sector job, white collar, blue collar, you name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. And employers love to hear what you're seeing if you're trying to hire people and retain people. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aki, what are businesses, and again, you focus on the white collar world here, what are businesses trying to do to keep the people they've already got?
Sure. So, you know, there are some executives right now that are pushing to go back into the office because they know that in a remote environment, employees don't feel as attached to their colleagues. And as a result, they're more likely to leave. They think that, forcing everybody back into the office is a great retention plan. And, you know, that actually, you know, most likely will make things worse because people have so many options now. You know, they can go to other employers that are offering work from home options or hybrid options. So that would probably backfire. But the thing that employers really need to do is to try to, you know, build that camaraderie in the workplace, even if employees are working remotely or working hybrid, both from home and the office. It's harder to do than when you're in the office 5 days a week, but it's not impossible. And the second thing is employers are going to have to hire a lot more recruiters just because, you know, in the age of the forever resignation, there are just going to be a lot more jobs to fill. And it probably also means that employers are going to have to hire more people across the board so that they're, you know, not constantly, they have more backups, you know, to come in when somebody leaves. If more people are going to be leaving constantly, that means that you have to staff up a little bit more to make sure that you can absorb those shocks.
We heard from Mary on the Ideas Network Facebook page who writes, "The company I work at has grown since COVID started. They increased starting wages to entice applicants and updated the pay scale to incentivize/reward existing employees." Mary adds, "While we lost some people due to regular turnover, a few from burnout during COVID, the overall headcount keeps increasing." That two-part thing there she mentioned, Aki, offering more pay to those new employees and at the same time bumping up the pay to keep existing employees. That sounds like it's been a hurdle for some places. They've done that first part, maybe lost people who are jealous of those new employees getting paid more than they were.
Yeah, I actually just wrote a story about this, and I think it really hit a nerve because I think these employers who've, you know, stuck around at their companies for a long time are seeing these new hires come in at much higher salaries than what they're earning. It sounds like, you know, the Facebook user who posted to your site, you know, their employer has been proactive and actually has raised wages for existing employees too. Companies that are proactive like that aren't going to see the kind of attrition rates that other companies that are less proactive are seeing right now because they're, you know, going out of their way to try to retain those existing employees. And, you know, probably in the short term, it seems more expensive, but in the long run, by keeping their talented employees, I bet it's ultimately a cost-saving measure.
It's Brianna Caller now at 800-642-1234. Amy is with us in Ozaukee County. Amy, hi.
Hi. I was calling. I retired early from my job because I'm really working really, really, really long hours. I mean, I love my job, and I was doing more work. There wasn't as many employees, and it was very stressful. So I decided to retire early. I think the management was not good. Poor management. So, I retired early, and I really didn't want to because I love my job. So,
Amy, do you have thoughts of going back into the workforce? Obviously, probably not for the same company.
Yes, I do. I am retired, but I do have another job, and it's a lot less stressful, and I'm a caregiver. So,
excellent.
So for an elderly woman, so it's, you know, it's a lot less stressful and, in a lot of ways, you know, it's pretty rewarding.
Excellent. Amy, thanks so much. Aki, a couple things there. I think there's been in some workplaces, the idea that, yeah, you got to work the long hours, like it or lump it. The competition's going to offer the same. Workers like Amy may not put up with that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we saw a lot of that, especially during the pandemic. After the initial layoffs in the steep recession at the beginning of the pandemic, there were fewer people around to do the same amount of work or even more work. So many people got burned out. We're still seeing that now. A lot of people, you know, left their companies, or they may have left the workforce for good, as was probably initially the case for Amy. We're actually seeing older workers now come back out of retirement now. It's a trend that's called unretirement. It sounds like that's what Amy did as well. And, you know, I'm so happy to hear about her experience because, you know, she went from a really stressful job to a less stressful job. She went to a job that feels more rewarding. And that's amazing. You know, that's exactly the kind of, you know, the kind of transitions that you like to see in a hot job market, the kind of hot job market that we are seeing right now.
Amy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, with us today to talk about the still ongoing great resignation, more people than usual leaving their jobs for one reason or another, the possibility that at least in some lines of work, it could turn into a forever resignation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did you change jobs during the pandemic? Are you thinking about making a switch now? What's driving that, or what's driving you to stay in your line of work, your career? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're an employee or employer, you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the great resignation still going strong and why some analysts think high turnover may become the norm in some jobs anyway. Aki Ito with Business Insider has been writing about it, stays with us now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences deciding to switch a job, leave a job, or stay on the job, or trying to convince people to work for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott joins us in Appleton. Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me on. My question and stuff is more of what are companies doing if they're changing how they're treating their employees? Are they starting to treat their employees more so like people, or is it still continuing the, oh, I'm just a number to kind of mentality?
Scott, interesting question. Aki, is there some of what Scott's looking for there, treating employees, he says, more like people?
Anecdotally, from workers in all kinds of different industries, you know, not every company is able to compete with, you know, these sky-high salaries that we're seeing in the market right now. And so as a result, they're trying to pull on other levers to, you know, make their workplace more attractive to new hires and also to existing employees too. One of the best ways to do that is just to build a better culture, right? To, you know, get rid of the toxic bosses and to make the workplace just a more humane place, less burnout, that kind of thing. So I'm absolutely hearing that on the ground.
I mean, that sounds easy to do. Is it really easy to do if you've built up a work culture for 5, 10, 20 years?
Probably not, especially, you know, if, you know, you have a remote workplace now and you have less interaction amongst colleagues. But it's a huge priority for companies. And, you know, there's nothing that is more alarming to executives than these really high resignation rates right now. It's one thing to get complaints from employees, but if your best employees leave you altogether, nothing screams, you know, we need to make a change the way that those numbers do.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Tom in Milwaukee. You couldn't stay on the line. Tom's seeing a renewed interest in labor unions out there, wonders if there's a link to this maybe more power in the hands of workers being able to move from one job to another. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the hot job market and the increased bargaining power that workers are having is a key reason that we're seeing such high collective bargaining rates. Certainly unionization in the U.S. is still very low compared to what it used to be before and compared to other advanced countries. But we're seeing this real resurgence in unions. And I think a big part of that is because workers feel more empowered right now than they have been in a really long time.
Now, there's fears that a recession could, eventually a recession will come along again. I think that's the way the economy works. Fears that it could be, next year or something. Are there thoughts that this conversation we're having now will be obsolete once a recession hits and maybe that's going to tighten things up and lower the options for these workers?
Sure. So, certainly if a recession does come, the labor market isn't going to be as hot as we're seeing right now. And as a result, I think the resignation rates are going to come down somewhat. But even in that pit of recession, I really, Gartner is arguing that we're never going to see the kind of low quit rates that we saw in the 2010s before the pandemic. We're never going to see that again because even in a recession, we're still going to have a lot more remote work than we did before. And that just permanently changes the way that the labor market operates.
Now, we heard from Karen in Green Bay, who said she hopes companies turn to remote work and keep older employees who have a lot of knowledge. Is there a thought, Aki, that that's a good target for employers, their current older employees, or maybe people who have left other jobs, that could be a source to fill these gaps they need?
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a good idea to me. We've actually heard of the opposite, too, that there's quite a bit of ageism in the labor market. A lot of people who are, maybe over 50 don't even want to disclose their ages because they seem less employable. And if it is the case that companies are hiring more older workers, I think that's fantastic. In a really hot labor market, the kind of workers that are traditionally, less attractive to employers, including, people of color, people with criminal backgrounds, and probably older workers too, the kind of workers who get discriminated against in traditional labor markets, employers kind of start to hire from those pockets as well because, they have no choice but to. And that's really great for, the entire economy. That's exactly what you want to see in an economic expansion.
Aki Ito is with us from Business Insider. She recently wrote about the Great Resignation and whether it's going to keep going on well into the future, especially in some industries. Still time for your calls with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. Gene joins us now in Milwaukee. Gene, hi.
Hi. I just was calling in to let you know that I lost my job from acquisition during COVID, and I figured out how to reduce my lifestyle to stay retired, and so I wanted to make you aware of that. And then also I had a question how you're saying that the job market makes it better for U.S. citizens to negotiate pay, but I would think that it would also make employees, potential employees from India or other countries to also try to get a job here.
Gotcha. Gene, we don't have too much time left. So a couple of things there, Aki. Let's start with that second point first. I've seen some people in the business world say, hey, we're having trouble hiring people, especially in certain jobs. Is anybody trying to make it easier for people from other countries to get those jobs?
I think we are starting to hear of employers hiring overseas too, kind of an offshoring of knowledge work as well. I haven't heard about it too much because I think there's a lot of kind of tax complications and employment law complications related to that. But I am hearing that, and that will probably be a much bigger concern down the road as, you know, companies get a lot more used to remote work. If you can, you know, if you're a company based in New York City and, you know, you can hire somebody, you know, in Nevada, for, let's say, what's stopping you from hiring somebody all the way in India, you know, who has an even lower cost of living? But I'm not hearing about it too much so far.
And Jean's personal experience was interesting. She lost her job because of an acquisition. Bad news. But then she says she downsized her retirement expectations and is cool with retirement now. And I mean, I've heard anecdotally, Aki, that that was something happening with workers who retired a little bit earlier than planned. They just kind of adjusted their retirement lifestyle expectations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's great to hear that she was able to make it work and, you know, she can stay retired now. I wish I were retired too. I have many decades ahead of me before that's going to be a financial feasibility for myself. But I do think, you know, one thing that's complicating that picture right now is inflation. You know, a lot more people are coming out of retirement right now because, you know, they just can't rely on their fixed income. It just doesn't make up for the amount of inflation that we're seeing right now. So that's one thing to keep an eye out on as well.
Aki, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was great.
We've been talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, who covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. She was with us today to talk about why some analysts think the great resignation, a lot of people leaving jobs, switching jobs, retiring early, why that may not end anytime soon, what that could mean for workers and businesses. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that and maybe your own experience. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin philosopher joins the show to talk about community grief and trauma after the COVID-19 death toll crossed 1 million in the U.S. last week. Remember, you can follow these conversations all day, every day at WPR.org, listen live, or check out archive conversations, or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen wherever you go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sociologist who studies partner violence highlights some concerns she has coming out of the high-profile defamation trial wrapping up this week that actor Johnny Depp brought against his ex-wife, Amber Heard. Now, 1 million people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. That's according to numbers out last week from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. It's a number that can be hard to wrap our heads around. And after hearing stories about the growing death toll for more than 2 years now, it's easy to become numb to the level of pain and grief caused by the pandemic. Our next guest studies mass trauma and how communities and countries collectively remember it. He's with us today to talk about making sense of great loss. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel overwhelmed? Is it hard for you to comprehend fully how many people have died in this pandemic? If so, you are definitely not alone. Have you or someone you know lost a loved one? What has grieving during the pandemic been like for you? If you lost someone, whether it was because of COVID-19 or another cause. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Boynton is a philosopher and edited the book Trauma and Transcendence, Suffering and the Limits of Theory. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
It can be, of course, tough to cope with the loss of one loved one. A million deaths, a huge number. How do we start to wrap our minds around that?
Right. I mean, this is an age-old problem. The difficulty of coming to terms with a single death. I mean, a single death can be incalculable in certain ways, but death on a mass scale that infects that affects entire population. And in this case, as it has in the past, affects the whole world, is a scale that is difficult to find the modes by which to calculate or capture the kind of loss. And so the feeling, the recognition of this loss is one of just overwhelm, of inability, recognizing that the powers or abilities we have to take stock of what has just happened always come up short. And it's that recognition of inability that has to be paid attention to, I think, in the very first instance of trying to grasp what essentially comes across as ungraspable. That might be a start at the answering that kind of question.
Are there things we can do as communities, as society, I don't know, at the government level to memorialize, to do things ritually or symbolically to help us cope and understand this?
Right. So there's been some interesting movements around in memory studies, collective memory studies and memorialization, really since the first half of the last century, after the atrocities of the First and Second World Wars. You know, memorialization is often about a country or a nation reckoning with its past and setting its course for its future. And so a lot of memorialization over the past centuries has been about large stony obelisks, large monuments that talk about overcoming odds or talk about victories or talk about ways of gathering together a nation and pointing towards a different kind of future. And this is always about moments of inauguration. So a nation rallies around some kind of event that then opens up what it means to be a citizen to that nation. In this case, we're finding over the last 80 years or so, there's been a shift in memorialization around recognizing the inability to talk about victories, to memorialize in stony kind of positive ways what has just happened. So one quick example of this, of course, is the 9/11 memorial in New York City with the reflecting pools that essentially are reflections of absence. So the loss of buildings, the absence of buildings, the footprint where the buildings once stood now become a waterfall that flows down into this dark abyss. And so it's actually using absence as a way of memorializing what happened on 9/11. And that technique has been around now for a number of decades, and it's being used more and more as a way of, again, thinking about what has happened in 9/11 or thinking about what happened in the atrocities in World War II as a way of setting a course for a nation going forward, not by something positive, but by a counter monument, by a monument that also reflects where civilization went awry, where we find such a deep and a profound loss that there's nothing that can fill in that gap. And so the only thing left to do is to memorialize it as loss, as gap, as inability to truly fathom. So the 9/11 memorial are one of those things, but also memorials for the murdered Jews of Europe in the heart of Berlin is another example of that. And the recent memorial in Birmingham, Alabama, to the numerous lynching victims in the South is another reflection of this kind of memorialization that still attempts to chart a path forward for a nation, but not by men on horses, but through other means. Rob, does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. We're talking to philosopher Eric Boynton from Beloit College, provost and dean there, looking at how we cope or comprehend the scale of loss from something like COVID-19. As the U.S. just passed a million deaths last week, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, I wonder if there's something about the way this all proceeded, the deaths, as opposed to a horrific but very public event like a 9/11 or a hurricane or natural disaster. So much of the suffering and death happened in emergency rooms, in homes, where we weren't confronted with it, didn't witness it in the moment or day to day. Does that affect how we how we process it, how we understand the scale of it.
Yeah, Rob, I think that's a great question. I do think there's a difference. Hitting a million deaths over 2 years due to pandemic, I think is very different than commemorating loss due to horrific tragedy, warfare, those kinds of events. Even 9/11, which, you know, the planes hit and within a few hours the buildings fell. So that really is an event that you can place a day upon. But the pandemic is a slow burn, and there's something about living through this moment for so many months and spreading this million deaths over so many months that has, I think, it's a different way of taking stock. There's a way in which the dramatic kind of loss is now felt as a malaise, as an underlying anxiety about the future versus a momentary flash that makes you think or question the future. Now there's this ongoing task to negotiate the world in the midst of pandemic, in the midst of loss, in the midst of continuing loss, that is very different than a one-time kind of event that maybe we could memorialize in other ways. So I do think sometimes after atrocities, you know, the future is dark. The future is not open for me to step into. In this situation, I'm constantly moving into the future in the midst of a pandemic. But I think there's a way in which we're moving into the future, negotiating ongoing anxiety, ongoing threat, ongoing malice, the world kind of pressing in on us in ways that is different this time. I don't know, Rob, does that make sense to you?
Sure. And now you've also talked elsewhere about the role of misinformation and why someone might seek it out or be at least approachable for it. Can you tell us how that comes into play with your thoughts on the pandemic?
Right. So I think if you look back in history, the ways in which we as humans writ large, dealing with these kinds of mass events of suffering and atrocity and loss, there is always attempts to try to grasp this thing, to try to put it into contained, give it some kind of parameter so that I can talk about what just happened. And there's ways in which thinking about drilling down on, put it this way, calculating the loss is one attempt to begin to take stock of what has just happened due to the pandemic. So, running numbers, a million versus 500,000, we could still have this our conversation if it was a million or 1.5 million. The numbers aren't really important in this sense of the loss overwhelming us. But we also have this desire to take stock, to control, to think about how it is we might have done things differently, how we might do things differently in the future, how I can organize my life presently right now to gain control of this thing. And my idea, and I don't know if I can defend this all the way down, but my idea is that the belief in misinformation is one way of gaining control of that which feels overwhelming. So it's the attempt to not even pay attention to the pandemic as pandemic. It's a way of taking stock of calculating the pandemic by not paying attention to it. And so I think it's far from belief in misinformation is far from turning your back on the pandemic. I think it's actually facing the pandemic, and it's a way or a technique or a mechanism by which to deal with what it is that we're all facing.
We're talking to Eric.
In that regard, go ahead, Rob.
We're talking to Eric Boynton, philosopher and provost and dean of Beloit College, with us today to help us think about what it means for the U.S. to lose a million people to COVID-19. We crossed that milestone last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has it been hard for you to wrap your mind around how many people have been lost in this pandemic? How do you think we should commemorate locally, nationally, within families, people lost over this time? How do you think we'll remember this in future generations? And a few moments ago, I said, we didn't see this happen. You know, we didn't see all the suffering and loss, except Some of us did. If you worked in hospitals and emergency rooms and saw the harm done by this day after day, I would appreciate it if you'd be willing to share how you tried to cope with that, how you wrapped your mind around it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the million lives lost in the U.S. because of COVID-19. We crossed that milestone officially anyway last week. And how to understand the level of loss, the pain and suffering that comes with that. Eric Boynton of Boyd College, philosopher there, stays with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience with loss during the pandemic. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Appleton. Brian, hi.
Hi. I'm a healthcare worker, and I know there was a better possible outcome for this thing. Day after day, I can't tell you how many patients that I would see in primary care that were going to listen to their Fox News more than they would listen to their physician. And inevitably, it would come true. And then even after the fact, they would still not believe it. And I think it's appalling that the politicians in the area here were willing to risk their constituents' health in order to rally the troops as opposed to do the right thing. That's all I had to say.
Well, Brian, can I ask before you go? I know some healthcare workers were driven out of the field because of some of what you just mentioned. Are you still in there doing the job?
Well, I'm sundowning because of retirement, but otherwise, yes.
Okay. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that story. Eric, Brian brings up something else maybe unique about the pandemic and how we deal with it. The divisiveness, the politics that came up around it, and a lot of the misinformation that attached to that, how does that affect things?
Yeah, I do think there's a way in which the pandemic, of course, every kind of mass event like this, suffering on a mass scale, has ripple effects. It ripples through families, it ripples through communities. But I think this is exactly right, that this pandemic also has effects or ripple effects that exacerbate the issues that the pandemic has inflicted on us as a community and brought to the fore what was already there in terms of divisiveness, which I think, frankly, adds to the feeling that I talked about before, this basic malaise that kind of hangs over the pandemic, is that as a nation, we can't rally around a single interpretation or understanding of what it is that's happened. And that's actually something that memorialization or commemoration attempts to do, is to draw together a variety of different approaches into more or less a single trajectory. And it might be difficult in the near term to really come to terms with what happens because of the divisiveness itself. And so if there's a way in which the people on the front lines giving aid to those who are suffering are not only impinged by the disease and what they see all around them, but also the ways in which their work is not being valued, I think that's a ripple effect from what it is that we're experiencing on this kind of mass scale.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Eric, I've seen people throughout the course of this talk about the concept of psychic numbing, and it comes up again with the latest horrific mass shooting as well. This idea that we see it so much and we desensitize to it, but maybe there's an upside there too, because you can't live constantly meditating on the horror of loss from COVID and the pandemic. How do we find a middle ground, if that's such a thing?
Right. No, this is difficult. And this is, we can look at the events in Texas, at the pandemic. I mean, the world is replete. I mean, we can look in different regions around the world currently, Ukraine, for instance, or, current health disparities in the United States, for instance. All those things will lead to, what I've heard as a kind of fatigue, right? A numbness, sometimes referred as compassion fatigue. There is a need, I think, to turn off, you know, in order that those kinds of events aren't crushing for everyone. But that can only go so far, because the reason why you're desensitizing, or the reason why you're turning your back on those things, is because they're so pressing. It's because they ought not be. It's because we have to apply ourselves to those constant pressures that are tearing us down and tearing down our world. And so there's no ability not to pay attention. And because of that, we find ourselves worn out and fatigued. So I think it's a kind of a balancing act. There's going to be a shift, but the fact is that we find ourselves fatigued is pointing to the phenomenon that we cannot properly live in a world that has these kinds of events in it, that we have to do something, whether it's taking charge and working on overcoming the conditions that allow those events to take place, or desensitizing. Either one of those things is in itself a kind of reaction. So, you know, one of the ways in which we can find ourselves better able to attend to the suffering all around us is not always to think about empathy, the ways in which I have to imagine someone else's suffering in order to understand what's going on. But there's a way in which allowing our own suffering to do its work, and that actually opens us up to the suffering of others. And so there's a way in which a community community who comes together around what it is that's happening to us collectively is maybe a one approach to get at this problem of fatigue.
One thing I'd wanted to ask about before we run out of time, Eric, is I've talked to people who've done projects, including an online project called Who We Lost, giving like a little personal window into people who have been lost. And we see in the coverage of children lost this week in Texas, telling us some, not just them, about one of the number of people killed, but something about them individually. How important is to have that, I guess, that personal image of people we've lost, as opposed to the statistic of people we lost?
No, I think that's vitally important, that you have to do all of those things. So one example of that is if you take the Vietnam War Memorial, which when you stand back is this dark cut into the earth. But when you come close, it's the stones upon which individual names are cast. And then, interesting enough, your reflection is in the stone itself. And so the Vietnam War Memorial, I think, has that doubleness to it, is both the individual names and also the weight or the size of the loss. In a number of memorials in Germany and Poland, there is the Book of Life, which is the documentation of all the Jewish people who were lost to the Holocaust, and each individual name is listed there. But in addition, and this is also in Israel, but in addition, you see the mass of pages hanging before you. It's the largest book you've ever seen. So that kind of combination of both individual human loss on a very private scale, and the ways in which that loss has deep and profound effects for the people around that person, and at the same time, seeing the multiplication of each one of those deaths on this mass scale. I think that in combination is what needs to be accomplished.
Briefly, Eric, we just have a minute left. Do you see efforts? Are we doing enough to try to memorialize the individuals and the mass of people lost during the pandemic?
Oh, I think we're in the thick of it. I don't think I've seen a good one. You know, the New York Times has attempted to do this a couple times. I think that proper memorialization comes with some time, the ability to look backwards a bit and think about what it is that, as best we can, the ways in which we can begin to point or gesture to what it is that's occurred to us as a collective people. So I think it's probably too soon, Rob, to take a stab at that. I do think there's probably people who are thinking about what a memorial will look like. The thing is that the memorial in this nation might be different than a memorial in another nation, and there might be some desire for a global reckoning as well, but I don't know what that would be yet.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Eric Boynton, philosopher who studied trauma and how societies remember it. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. He was with us today to talk about lives lost to COVID-19. As of last week, the U.S. death toll crossed 1 million and how we comprehend loss on that scale. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, having fun is a seriously important part of life. That's according to the author of the new book, The Power of Fun, How to Feel Alive Again. Find out more tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're like me, you have a hard time with folding things neatly. Honestly, you're probably not like me. I'm really bad at this. I have the kindergarten report cards to prove it, and I haven't gotten any better since then. But there is some hope out there in the food department. A group of engineering students at Johns Hopkins University invented an edible tape to help keep burritos folded up properly. Now, a certain team of public radio talk show producers made fun of this idea. I'm not going to name any names, but they questioned whether anyone really needs this. Well, I think I kind of do. Folding burritos looks simple, easy, when other people do it. And yet, I end up with this misshapen heap with filling dripping out from all sides, even when I'm careful not to overfill it. So I might give this edible burrito tape a try someday. Now, could somebody do something about those fitted sheets? This is Central Time.